Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Happy Super Tuesday, everyone, and thanks a lot for your pledges yesterday. So we are pledge-free today. That little twice the money and one day kind of experiment worked. The drive resumes tomorrow. Now, quick, can you name all 10 Super Tuesday states and their license plate slogans? Okay, in the east, it's Massachusetts, Vermont, Georgia, and Virginia. Then working our way west, more or less, Ohio, Tennessee, Oklahoma, North Dakota, and Idaho, and finally, Alaska. In an hour from now, we'll go state by state. We'll spend 5 minutes in each of the 10 states getting quick political takes and listing every state's license plate slogans. Some states have two. But right now, we'll kick off Super Tuesday with Dave Weigel, political reporter for Slate, also an MSNBC contributor, and Karen Tumulty, national political correspondent for The Washington Post. Hi, Dave. Hi, Karen. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hello. Thanks so much. It's great to be here.
Karen, why does Super Tuesday exist? Why do primaries scatter across the calendar before today and then bunch up today? And why does it seem to be a different list from the Super Tuesday states we saw in 2008?
Well, Super Tuesday was essentially invented in 1988 by a number of moderate Southern Democrats, including Al Gore and Chuck Robb of Virginia. And basically, this was the Democratic Leadership Council people who had decided that they needed something that resembled a national primary, because going state by state, they believed that their party was picking nominees who were basically too liberal to survive in a general election. So that's how it started. And what has set up the schedule this time around is really changes in the Republican primary rules, where states that it's much smaller number. Last time, 4 years ago, there were over 20 states voting on February 5th, which was Super Tuesday then.
Including New York.
And California. And Illinois,
and New
really
Jersey.
Big states. But the Republican Party has changed its rules this time so that there are states that vote early can't go winner take all, which is a way to really amplify your impact on the process. So a number of these states moved their dates later.
And Dave, in the past, most states in the Republican primaries were winner take all. Now most seem to allocate their delegates about in proportion to the popular vote. Why did they change? And why am I hearing that the party is coming to regret that decision?
Well, they changed. Karen gave a really good summary of why the changes began, and I think the changes this year were not really anticipated to have this much of a slowdown effect on the process. I mean, they were there to keep the states relevant, but a lot of these states, like Oklahoma, for example, have rules that allow you to basically win all the delegates if you outperform. For example, Oklahoma, if Rick Santorum wins 50% statewide, he gets all the statewide delegates. If he wins 50% in a district, gets all the ones in the district. If he falls under that, then it goes proportional. Mm-hmm. And the problem is that we've ended up in a situation with a bunch of candidates who are horribly weak in particular ways as far as the base is concerned. And it's dragging a bit longer than any Republican would like. I mean, even though they set these systems up, it's like finding a dodo, finding a Republican who thinks this system is working out well for them vis-a-vis Barack Obama.
And listeners, I think, Karen, go ahead.
Well, I think, too, one of the things that the Republican Party was not counting on was the effect of the super PACs and the fact that they would unleash this just avalanche of negative advertising, so that rather than having a long, leisurely primary process strengthen their candidates, it in fact is running up their negatives.
Thank you, Citizens United. And it's ironic because the Republicans wanted that ruling. The Democrats did not, because Republicans usually benefit more from unlimited corporate donations in the general election, including to so-called independent groups. But I guess this spigot is also keeping Gingrich and Santorum's candidacies alive and going negative against Romney when the party would prefer they drop out, yes?
It has, at first, kind of a democratizing effect, ironically, because Gingrich and Santorum were able to stay in when they didn't have enough, they weren't raising enough money on their own in their own campaigns through the usual systems of Republican fundraising. They were bailed out, basically, by, in Santorum's case, Foster Freese, in Gingrich's case, Sheldon Adelson's network. But we're starting to see that falter because 10 states vote today, and you can give $10 million to a candidate. But you've got Georgia and Massachusetts and Ohio all voting. That money doesn't actually spread that far. So Romney's Super PAC Restore Our Future has actually been able to retake the advantage because it has more money. I mean, I bring up Oklahoma again because we're not paying a ton of attention to it. That's a state that had it been a one-on-one race, it's pretty clear Santorum would have defeated Romney handily. But right. Romney has outspent him on the air. The Romney Super PAC has outspent him by 50-1 and cut his advantage there. It's starting to outspend people in the other southern primaries. And yeah, so it had a distorting effect on the primary. Now we're resorting to the mean of the guy with the most money winning.
Listeners, anything you want to know or want to say about Super Tuesday? Dave Weigel from Slate, Karen Tumulty from The Washington Post are here for you, 212-433-WNYC. Call in about any state, call in about the process, whatever, 212-433-9692, or post to our page at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Karen, how much do you think the role of women voters is changing in these primaries after what's been happening in the last week with contraception and Rush Limbaugh and the candidates' kind of weak denunciations of him over calling a college student a prostitute, saying she wanted to be paid to have sex for wanting contraception to be covered in her health insurance plan? Is there polling or anything that indicates whether women who might have voted in these primaries today are getting turned off from the Republican Party altogether, or is it benefiting one candidate more than another? Any clue about the political impact of all this?
You know, I will really be watching the results tonight to figure that out. It's been very interesting to see what has happened with women voters thus far. In South Carolina, Newt Gingrich won the women's vote quite handily. And then in Florida, it switched and went the other way. You know, I don't know what this is doing to women voting within Republican primaries, but I think the big impact is likely to be in the general election, where Democrats have a traditional edge with women, and I don't think that what's been going on these last few weeks is going to help the Republicans in that regard.
And Santorum, Dave, even though he's sort of the most anti-contraception candidate and seen as the most conservative on these sexual issues, he had no gender gap to speak of, 2 points in Michigan last week, and he actually did better among women than he did among men by 6 points in Arizona.
Oh, he did, but I mean, Republican women are generally more conservative than the counterparts who are most outspoken about at least this latest Limbaugh-driven iteration of the birth control issue. I'm in Duluth, Georgia right now, and I heard Gingrich talk about the issue, and the way he discussed it was that the media is focusing on Rush Limbaugh because it's just their latest attempt to distract from the issues of the election. In other cases, he says that their attempt to distract from the key issue of conscience, of how the Obama rule is violating the First Amendment, basically, by violating by forcing Catholic Church to get something they don't want. And when it's framed that way, a lot of female Republican voters who agree with that. So I don't, inside the Republican primary, I think it's just seen as a really irritating media-driven distraction. But on the fundamentals of the issue, I don't think you see a lot of women fleeing from one candidate or another because of it. Now, again, like Karen's right. Let's see what happens today, and especially in the more liberal parts. I mean, Vermont and Massachusetts are voting. Even the Republican voters there are a bit more moderate than they are in the South.
To this point, I want to play a clip of Rick Santorum reacting the other day to the Limbaugh comments. We played this yesterday, but I'm going to ask a very different question today than I asked yesterday. Listen.
Well, he's being absurd, but that's, an entertainer can be absurd. And he's taking the absurd the absurd, point of view here as to how far do you go? And look, he's in a very different business than I am. I'm concerned about the public policy of this president imposing his values on people of faith who morally object to the government telling them they have to do something which they believe is a grave moral wrong.
So, Karen Tumulty, I'm curious about Rush Limbaugh's place in Republican politics. It seems to me that at the beginning of the Obama administration, Limbaugh got credited in a lot of Republican quarters for helping to give the backbone to the Republicans to become the party of no, to not really play ball with Barack Obama and his attempt at postpartisanship in a very serious way. And now Santorum is dismissing him as merely an entertainer. So what is Rush Limbaugh's role in the Republican Party at this point?
Well, I think Rush Limbaugh has a very strong, very devoted following. And what we're hearing in Rick Santorum's comments here is an effort to sort of tap dance around that and to avoid alienating the people who listen very avidly and to Rush Limbaugh's show.
Dave, any other take on that? I've seen some skeptical writing about Limbaugh in the last few days that he really doesn't have the power to turn out voters and affect elections, but I've heard other takes at other times. So what's your political analysis of his place in the Republican Party?
I mean, he has a unique place because he's not like Sean Hannity constantly interviewing the candidates. I mean, he is kind of a independent analyst, but he puts down stakes, and a Republican really can't get very far away from that stake and be safe with the base. He has, I think, a better line over to what the average Republican is thinking than just about anybody in the country. So this has been a the interesting thing about this issue is when Republicans were asked about Limbaugh, and I thought that was a little bit strange in the first place. I mean, he says lots of things that people find odious, and Republicans are always asked. They didn't really disagree with the substance of the comment, apart from the insult that it just this is not something the government has any right to. It's not a right that people have to have health insurance pay for this. You know, Michelle Bachmann, I think last night, asked about it four times on CNN, made that point too. So I mean, even when he errs, Limbaugh is very close to the mainstream of Republican thinking on a public policy issue like this.
Dan in Massapequa, you're on WNYC. Good morning, Dan.
Hey, good morning, Brian. Great show as always. I was getting ready to talk about the various things I've learned about the Republican primary system here. You know, I'm a conservative voter, but now you've talked about the big idiot, and that's how I refer to Mr. Limbaugh. As you know, I spent the last 23 years driving around New York City in a police car as a police officer and as a supervisor, and I have many things I can listen to on the radio, and it's never been him, and it never will be. He doesn't represent anything other than his ego, and I could care less what he has to say on the subject. And furthermore, I have a teenage daughter, and if you ever call my daughter that, I would take care of him personally. It wouldn't be a problem. Uh-huh. Now, listen, about the Republican primary. It's amazing how long this has gone on and how much I have learned about the various states and how the various states choose their delegates, how they conduct their votes. And it's absolute chaos. I can't believe various states have caucuses where it basically you can vote for one guy and then change your vote. Then the delegates aren't legally obligated. Some guys aren't on the ballot in some states. Rick Santorum can't get on the ballot in some states because he has to apply in each different district. It's unbelievably difficult. I don't understand why it can't be maybe six or seven different events, a winner-take-all system. And I think if the Republican Party is smart, they'll change that because this is the last thing in the world they want is this ongoing battle. And it'll all be forgotten. If Romney has a great day today, and I hope he is, I'm not my first choice, but I think he's electable. I don't think he scares the average moderate voter. I think they'll vote for him, even though they don't agree with him on every position. I think he's electable. I think he can beat the president. But if it goes on any longer, I think it's just it's just people lose interest in it.
Dan, thank you very much for your call, as always. And what about, Karen, the complexity of the process? I mean, number one, I think it isn't just a Republican thing. The Democrats do it too. And from state to state, it's usually designed, I think, all these complex rules. In order to get on the ballot, you have to have X number of signatures in each congressional district and all these different percentages for how you get the delegates. It's intended to keep power in the hands of a certain kind of party machine, and again, both parties, from state to state. That's primarily the point, isn't it?
Yes, and I think that one thing that is going to be really questioned after this primary season is the time-honored caucuses. We've always treated them as though they're this kind of quaint, you know, artifact where neighbors come out and discuss politics with their neighbors and sort of democracy at its finest. But the fact is that they have sown nothing but confusion this time around, starting with the fact that Iowa got the winner wrong. And I am wondering if people are going to have sort of such a soft spot in their hearts for the caucus systems after this election year.
Mike in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Mike.
Hello. My question is more about, you know, when you refer to the Republican Party, just who is that? There was an article in the New Yorker this week by Ryan Leza, which talks about the evolution of the primaries and all that. And it just seems that one of the trends in politics is that the party becomes more and more amorphous or hard to find. And, you know, I'm not sure who you refer to when you say the party wants this, the Republican Party.
It's a great question, and I did refer earlier to the Republican Party coming to regret these changes in the rules. That's probably what you're referencing. And yet it's the party at a certain institutional bureaucratic level, Dave, that makes the rules, right? There is an organization that's the Republican National Committee or whatever they call it, Democrats too, where they make the rules as to who votes when are the primaries going to be, with the result hoped for of getting a candidate who's more moderate or one thing or another. So there is something that is the party, right?
There is, but it is more chaotic than you've seen in the past. And when you talk from primary to primary, you're comparing in some cases a caucus system where a Republican vote can... Sorry, there's something breaking through my line.
Well, that's right. Karen, you want to finish this thought?
Well, I do think that the parties themselves have, on a national level, have almost ceased to exist. Yes, they can set the rules. Yes, they can set the schedules. And you know what? We've seen the states come back and say, you know, we're going to ignore your rules and we're going to ignore your schedules, starting with Florida moving their primary up to January 31st and setting a scramble off. And the other thing is that parties used to really be the center of gravity of political power. But I think that with a number of things, including that Citizens United decision, the rise of the Tea Party movement, which was really a rebuke to the Republican establishment, I honestly don't understand or know what the real role of the party is in the modern political system.
Dave, has the Republican Party finished jamming your phone?
No, I think it was a caller trying to get in, the line getting mixed up. No, I was just saying, from state to state, you can have a caucus where Democrats walk in and cast Republican ballots and either walk away and never do anything else again, or maybe they're a Ron Paul voter who will vote for him and no other candidate, or you've got states that have closed primaries where only Republicans can vote, and those people have come into the party over a pretty studied process. Maybe they switched because Barack Obama gained them so much. I think it's fairly coherent. One problem I have with the discussion of this election, I think, is the idea that the parties are going to choose far apart nominees, and there's a greater need than ever for a centrist third party. I'm not actually sure that's true. Barack Obama's record, as much as it's in the interest of Republicans to call him a socialist, is going to be, you know, pretty much a straightforward social democratic record. The Republicans are going to nominate a pretty straightforward center-right candidate. I think, and after a couple months, they're going to have very coherent visions of what they will do in office. Mm-hmm. So I actually, that's not one thing that concerns me very much. As messy as this is, I mean, one thing Democrats get right is they do have the same proportional representation rules for the caucus and the primaries. Republicans, but with this hodgepodge, I have created a problem that they should probably fix next time.
You know, we're out of time, but I just want to ask a quick question, Karen, about one state tonight. And everybody's focusing on Ohio as the most important. But I see that in Virginia, this hope-for scenario that some Republicans have had, which is Romney versus only one not Romney, is actually going to be the case because both Gingrich and Santorum failed to get on the ballot in Virginia. So people would rather that it be Santorum or Gingrich. It would probably be more interesting. But it is just Ron Paul versus Romney. So is this a meaningful opportunity tonight to see if the not Romney vote can coalesce and he could actually lose a primary in a case where there's only one opponent?
I very much doubt that because so much of what Ron Paul stands for is, you know, anathema to many Republicans. But I do think Ron Paul has been one of the most interesting stories of this campaign season.
We leave it there with Karen Tumulty, national political correspondent for The Washington Post, and Dave Weigel, Slate political reporter and MSNBC contributor. Thank you both so much. Happy Super Tuesday.
Thank you.
And listeners, don't forget our Super Tuesday returns coverage. I'll be hosting tonight at 7 with Jeff Greenfield, Cokie Roberts, and a live exit poll call-in for Ohio primary voters who will be joining us right here on WNYC, 7 o'clock tonight. Hope you'll tune in, and we'll have our primary night live interactive county-by-county maps all night on our politics website, itsafreecountry.org. Coming up next, the U.S., Israel, and Iran. Jane Eisner from the Jewish Daily Forward on the Obama-Netanyahu meeting and what comes next.